We meet today in freedom's cause and raise our voices high. We'll join our hands in union strong to battle or to die.
Hold the fort, for we are coming. Union men, be strong. Side by side, we battle onward. Victory will come. See
our number. It wasn't the internet, of course, but you know, it was sort of the next best thing when unions needed the journalistic firepower to really fight back against employers willing to break the laws.
Apart from the fact that the strike took place at all in the thick of the Depression, the coming together of all workers, regardless of their background, made the confrontation at Fraser Mills a remarkable chapter in BC labor history.
If workers in the United States know little about our own history of struggle, we know even less about our neighbor to the north. So today we have not one but two stories of Canadian workers fighting back. In the first, we learn about how a little newspaper started labor journalism in Canada. The Rosslyn Evening World was the first labor newspaper in Western Canada and possibly the country. More than a century later, it still has lessons for today's labor journalism, showing what a union newspaper could be. Radio Labor brings us an interview with labor historian Ron Verzoux. Nearly 90 years ago, in the dark years of the Great Depression, union membership and the number of strikes in British Columbia fell dramatically. But every now and then, against all odds, workers took a stand. It happened in September 1931 at the Fraser Mills Lumber Plant on the shores of the Fraser River in Mellersville, now part of Coquitlam. A diverse group of rank-and-file workers set aside their racial divisions and came together to fight for better wages, better working conditions, and basic respect as human beings. The On the Line Stories of BC Workers podcast tells their story. And on this week's Labor History in 2, Rick Smith tells us about Thomas Morris Jr. and Joseph Kersine, two union postal workers here in Washington, D.C., who died on October 21, 2001, after they were exposed to deadly anthrax. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. I hope you enjoy the show, eh?
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labor.
Hello, I'm Marc Boulanger. As the labor movement experiences a rise in labor journalism with the advent of union websites and other outlets, it's valuable to glance back at the history of labor journalism to find lessons that could be applied today. An example is the history of a little newspaper called the Rosslyn Evening World. Rosslyn is a small town in southeastern British Columbia near the U.S. border. The Evening World was the first daily labor newspaper in Western Canada, and maybe in all of the country. To find out more about the Rosslyn Evening World, I talked to Ron Verzoux. Mr. Verzoux is a labor historian specializing in the labor history of the Pacific Northwest. I asked him about the Rosslyn Evening World.
I think it's true that the Rosslyn Evening World was the early sort of labor newspaper that we see maybe some of the remnants of today as the labor movement tries to engage in all the terrible issues that are facing us in the 21st century. However, it was a different place and a different time. As the world started its publishing life, really as a weekly at first and then a biweekly back in 1899, it was called the Industrial World then, by the way. It seemed like a name a bit more in keeping with a workers' newspaper. But anyways, and in many ways, Rosslyn was kind of Canada's Deadwood. I mean, you know, the old TV show we watched a few years ago, it had all the elements of a boomtown. It had makeshift buildings and numerous hotel bars, and maybe too many, and even more numerous brothels. It shared much of the good, bad, and the ugly that marked the mining west on both sides of the border. He had several newspapers, by the way, serving a population of about 6,000 people in the mountains of south central BC, quite close to the U.S. border. anyway, it differed from what we're talking about in terms of today's modern labor press in that it was actually a newspaper that attempted to be a newspaper. It wasn't trying specifically to be just a worker's spokesheet. It was really trying to be a newspaper. So in that sense, it was different, but at the same time, I think we learned some lessons from it.
You mentioned that the Newsboys went on strike.
I think probably pioneer journalists didn't really observe a special set of principles so much as they, kind of shot from the hip, editorially speaking, whenever it was required. And the World was that kind of paper. And one of its favorite targets was its arch rival, the Roslyn Miner. By the way, the Miner was the second daily in Roslyn. It started in 1896, and it quickly went from being a worker-friendly paper to being a mine owner's mouthpiece. One of the principles the World did observe, and its first editor, a fellow named Fred Moffat, who was actually a Toronto lawyer, did observe, was to be fair-minded as a newspaper for the whole community. Again, it wasn't just for the unionized workforce, and there were plenty of them, by the way, in Roslyn. Almost everybody, and including the Newsboys, were organized. It was not trying to be only a union paper, but it was trying to be a sheet for everyone, and it really made an effort to do that. When the workers struck the Roslyn mines, and there were several of them in those days, this was mining for copper and gold and silver and later rougher metals. When they struck in 1901, in the summer of that year, the paper, of course, went to their side and supported them. And Moffat was really not a trade unionist particularly, but he was strong on strike issue, and he was especially angry that the mine owners had refused to uphold BC's 8 hours law passed in 1897 and the federal law prohibiting the hiring of alien labor, even alien labor law. So those two legal issues took the union in and out of courtrooms for years, but Moffat fought the good fight. They lost it, by the way, in early 1902, but the World carried on. Moffat retired to a more conservative position in the nearby Nelson. But it went on till mid-1904, and it was supported by local merchants and their advertising and had several worker subscriptions. The World really had become a newspaper of record for the labor movement through the Kootenay district of B.C., and I think that it sort of stands alone in that sense. I think a lot of our union newspapers that came afterward were kind of, in some ways, not quite the same model as this paper, trying to be actually a community paper.
Between the Evening World to the unions in Rosslyn?
Well, I think the Newsboys might have been a little bit of a misnomer. I expect it was probably not just boys, but several men making their living at this. These were unionized workers, as was almost every worker in Rosslyn at the time. They actually were quite in sympathy. They belonged to the local labor council, and when the strike took place, it wasn't long before the Newsboys union went out in sympathy.
What have we learned from the Evening World of 120 years ago?
It was owned by Local 38 of the Western Federation of Miners. That was one of the more radical unions of the era. Later became the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers, which some listeners might remember. The Roslyn Union was the WFM's first Canadian local, and it seems it was a feather in the cap of leaders like legendary William Big Bill Haywood. By the way, Haywood visited the local in Roslyn, and he got some good advice from George B. Casey, a local executive member of Local 38. Stop drinking, Big Bill. And he actually did so. His autobiography suggests that he took George's advice and gracefully laid off the booze for a while anyway. When the unfortunately, he didn't really return the favor, because when the strike was lost in 1902, Big Bill considered it a big waste of money. It wasn't long after that, a few years after that, they started the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, and the WFM was an affiliate, a first affiliate. What we learned from the World 120 years ago was that it was Western Canada's first labor daily newspaper, which is a feat in itself. And really, it offered a model for the future. I don't think labor leaders and labor journalists took it up very seriously. You know, it wasn't the internet, of course, and we've changed our whole mode of communications since the World. But, you know, it was sort of the next best thing when unions needed the journalistic firepower to really fight back against employers willing to break the laws I've mentioned and keep their shareholders happy. And they did some pretty brutal things. There was violence. It wasn't as violent as, say, some of the big strikes in Colorado and Montana, and Idaho, but it was a pretty serious situation with Pinkerton private police running around harassing strikers and so forth. The second thing I think we learned was that the world showed that it was possible for a local union to develop and sustain a daily newspaper that would both fight for the rights of those workers and offer the reading public or the community an alternative to employer-owned media. And the employer-owned media in the guise of the Roslyn Miner that I mentioned earlier was a vicious media. It came after workers with a passion. So the world, was a first, and in some ways remains one of a kind in the history of our Canadian labor movement.
Welcome to another episode of On the Line, a podcast that aims to bring British Columbia's rich labor heritage to life. I'm your host, Rod Mickleborough. In this episode, we are focusing on a fascinating strike that took place during the dark years of the Depression. Overnight, the bottom had fallen out of the economy. Production stalled, markets dried up, and millions of Canadian workers were soon on the dole. It was a terrible time. Workers who did keep their jobs had their wages cut to levels not seen since the end of World War I. Many unions seemed to give up. How do you fight back against owners, many of whom were struggling themselves, when the ranks of the unemployed were full of workers glad to take a job, any job, no matter how low the pay?
Every morning at 6 o'clock, I go to my work. Overcoat buttoned up round my neck, no job would I shirk. Winter wine flow round my head, cutting up my face.
Union membership and the number of strikes fell dramatically. But every now and then, despite all the economic turmoil swirling around them, workers took a stand. It happened at the vast Fraser Mills lumber plant on the north shore of the Fraser River, 15 miles east of Vancouver, in what is now Coquitlam. When they were hit with their fifth wage cut in 20 months, employees said, enough is enough. They voted to strike. On the morning of September 17, 1931, hundreds of fired-up workers surrounded the mill. When General Manager Henry Mackin tried to drive through the pickets, they surrounded his car, rocking it back and forth. One cheeky striker popped the cigar out of his mouth before he was allowed to pass. The mill workers had recently joined the Lumber Workers Industrial Union, which was an affiliate of the militant communist-led Workers Unity League. But few were interested in communism. They had more immediate concerns than a revolution by the working class. They wanted their wage cut rolled back, an increase in rates for shingle weavers, less overtime, and better working conditions. In the words of Union President George Lamont, "We intend to fight the Fraser Mills Company not on the basis of communism, but on the basis of bread and butter." The Fraser Mills strike stands out for another reason. Its workforce was a proverbial rainbow of ethnic diversity. The largest group among them were French Canadian. Their roots went back 20 years to when the Western Canada Lumber Company first began recruiting workers from Quebec. They soon formed a distinct community, Maillardville, named after their first parish priest. There were also Brits, Scandinavians, and other Europeans. More significantly, there were also sizable numbers of Japanese, Chinese, and South Asian workers. It was this sort of racial mix that had doomed so many strikes in the past. White hostility and outright racism towards Asian workers kept them out of their unions. That made it easier for them to be used as strikebreakers, exploited by both companies and notorious labor contractors who controlled their employment. That did not happen at Fraser Mills. Apart from the fact that the strike took place at all in the thick of the Depression, the coming together of all workers, regardless of their background, made the confrontation at Fraser Mills a remarkable chapter in BC labor history. The leader of the strike was a 27-year-old shingle weaver named Harold Pritchett. He began working in local sawmills at the age of 15, working 10 hours a day for the princely sum of 10 cents an hour. By 1931, he was a committed trade unionist, veering strongly towards the left in his politics. Just 6 years later, Harold Pritchett was elected president of the brand new International Woodworkers of America, the IWA, the first Canadian to lead an international union. But Harold Pritchett cut his leadership teeth at Fraser Mills. He embraced the view of the Communist Party that race had no part in working-class struggle. Under his leadership, Japanese, Chinese, and South Asian workers were all represented on the strike committees. Women also played a large role. They presided over the union's large community kitchen, helped organize social events, and often joined in the picketing. Fraser Mills was arguably this province's first strike where diversity was a unifier and not a divider. Of course, in those days, no strike was easy. On day one, police showed up in force, half a dozen on horseback, to try and keep pickets from blocking the road into the mill. Many were members of the Unemployed Workers Association, who had been brought in by the Workers' Unity League to bolster the picket line. Tensions increased on day two, as even more police showed up. Cars crossing the line were bombarded by rocks and pieces of wood. A streetcar transporting non-union longshoremen to the docks had its windows smashed, although no one was hurt. On day three, police moved in and arrested 10 pickets. 8 were charged with unlawful assembly, 2 with assaulting a police officer. Machine guns were mounted at the mill gates. Armed security guards patrolled the grounds, while police kept pickets under constant surveillance. There was also a war in the pages of Vancouver's daily newspapers, a verbal war. When the conservative, anti-union Vancouver province referred to the large number of pickets as a mob, the Vancouver Sun's popular columnist, Bob Bouchette, took issue in the male-oriented vernacular of the time.
Our spinster of Victory Square, ha, that's the province. Cannot understand why 700 rough, uncouth, sweaty fellows should halt the wheels of industry in this unladylike way. To spend week after week in backbreaking toil in exchange for the bare means of existence becomes too much, so they strike, as they have done at Fraser Mills. I think they have every reason for doing so. They have absolutely nothing to lose, and a strike is one way they have of bringing their condition to the attention of the public.
At this point, however, with the mill already shut tight, the strike committee decided further confrontations with police were counterproductive. They reduced the number of pickets to 25 a shift. This was not a sign of weakness or flagging spirits. When the arrested strikers made their first court appearance, 150 workers and supporters gathered outside. And they were not the only ones there. According to the British Columbian newspaper, 50 children of school age, marching two abreast, were brought from Millside, led by a determined-looking lady with a stout stick. There were still occasional dust-ups with police on horseback. On these occasions, strikers might well have taunted the Mounties with refrains from the popular 1920s song, "Horsey, Keep Your Tail Up." The jolly tactic was first used by workers at the nearby Barnett Mill in Burnaby, who were also on strike. Meanwhile, there were so many committees, it was hard to keep track. Bumming committees gathered donations in Maillardville and downtown Vancouver. Social committees organized picnics, sports events, dances with French-Canadian fiddles flying, and beer making to keep the fun level high. Skills were bartered to provide basic services, such as shoe repairs, haircuts, and supplying firewood. And there were the crucial food committees. Single men were fed at outdoor tables, their meals prepared by wives and mothers who ran the well-stocked kitchen. Harold Prichette's insistence that the mill's Asian workers were represented on all relief committees also paid off. Japanese farmhands from Hammond donated vegetables. Chinese farmers contributed daily supplies of chickens, eggs, and vegetables. There could be no better example of the benefit of including Asian workers in a union rather than excluding them, as much of the labor movement had for years. The striking union soon added two new demands: an end to the appalling company housing provided for South Asian employees, and an end to the company's use of labor contractors to supply them with Asian workers, which kept their wages 10 cents an hour below the rates paid to white mill workers. At a mass strike support meeting in New Westminster, Japanese millhand K. Mariana outlined their grievances. The contract system, he said, meant that Japanese workers had to go through a Japanese boss who, for all intents and purposes, was an agent for the company. Workers were hired and fired at will. They had no protection. If they joined the union, they could be blacklisted, Mariana told the large crowd. Yet join the union they did. No group was more solid than the large contingent of French Canadians. Besides the company and the police, they had to confront another foe, the Roman Catholic Church itself. Their parish priest, François Xavier Tech, was no fan of strikes. This one, he thundered from the pulpit, was the work of communists and radical revenge. He refused to let the union hold events at the parish hall, and that wasn't all. More seriously, Father Xavier Tech warned members of his flock that if they did not surrender their union cards, they would be denied absolution of their sins at confession. This was a big deal for his devout parishioners. Yet, only a few union cards trickled in. Most stood firm in favor of the strike, said one.
Father Tech is a good priest. We do what he tell us. On Sunday!
The union also helped out. A fleet of Model T Fords was rounded up to drive churchgoers to Sunday Mass in New Westminster, where there was a church with a more sympathetic priest. The strike kept going. After 3 weeks, the union got a boost. The Canadian Western Lumber Company was hit by another walkout. More than 300 workers went on strike at its lumber operation in Comox on Vancouver Island. This prompted the owners to soften their previous hard line. They offered to restore the wage cut that was the major reason for the Fraser Mills strike. They further agreed to increase the rate for shingle workers, reduce mandatory overtime, and there would be no discrimination against members of the union. All in all, it was not a bad offer, but it did not recognize the union. It did not provide a closed shop, nor did it end the contract system for Asian workers. The company also demanded that all employees vote on the offer by a secret ballot using the mails. Elected officials from nearby Coquitlam and Burnaby were called on to arrange the vote. It so happened that one of them was the Reeve of Burnaby, William Pritchard. Yes, that William Pritchard, longtime socialist, a former leader of the revolutionary One Big Union, and the guy who spent a year in Manitoba's Stony Mountain Penitentiary for his support of the Winnipeg General Strike in 1919. But those credentials cut no ice with one fiery communist speaker who denounced William Pritchard as, quote, a tool of the capitalists, unquote. Feeling their oats after taking on the company tooth and nail for 3 weeks, the strikers spurned the mail ballot. At a raucous union meeting, they voted unanimously by show of hands to reject the company's offer, 389-0. Picket lines stayed up. A week later, more than 100 strikers showed up to stop non-union longshoremen from loading lumber onto the SS Ravenas, bound for China. Squads of mounted police, some brought in from the Caribou, drove them back. At least a dozen strikers were injured from their swinging clubs. The union protested the police brutality to Ottawa. To no one's surprise, nothing was done. Around the same time, lumber baron H.R. McMillan and other forest titans met with the provincial cabinet. They complained that those nasty unions were threatening the right of workers to work for whatever wage the forest companies offered them. And they were right. Premier Simon Fraser Tolmie weighed in with support for the hard-done forest companies, blaming the familiar bogeyman of all strikes in those days, agitators and communists. Attorney General R.H. Pooley chose to lash out at, quote, imported radicals, unquote, for causing the strike, ignoring the fact that almost all the strikers worked and lived in the community. The workers' squeeze continued. All plant operations had ceased. Office staff were sent home. The company store was closed. Tugboats tied up. And the water pumps went dry. Union rowboats patrolled the river. Spirits were further roused by that huge support meeting organized by the New Westminster Labour Council. And speakers did not forget the plight of the mill's Asian workers and their wretched living conditions. A resolution was passed at the meeting demanding that, quote, the vermin-infested and unsanitary bunkhouses located in and on the property owned by Canadian Western Lumber Company and rented and occupied by Orientals and Hindus be abolished. There was also a legal victory. On November 13th, all 8 strikers charged with unlawful assembly were found not guilty. The jury deliberated only 20 minutes. The 2 strikers charged with assaulting a cop were convicted, but got off with only 1 day in jail. Still, after 9 weeks on strike, with the company showing no signs of more concessions, and Christmas just a month away, the union decided there was nothing to be gained from staying out. This time by secret ballot, workers voted 406-55 to accept the lumber company's last offer, take down their picket signs, and return to work. No one felt defeated. The Fraser Mills workers had managed to stay together and fight on for 6 more weeks to try and win union recognition. But it was not to be. In 1931 and into the 1940s, this remained a line in the sand on which industrial employers would not budge. Not until the Second World War did governments finally pass legislation that legally required employers to recognize and bargain with unions chosen by a majority of their workforce. It had only taken 70 years. And overall, the gains won by the Fraser Mills workers were nothing to sneeze at. The 10% wage cut was canceled. Shingle workers got their pay hike. A cap was put on overtime, and the company agreed to meet regularly with worker committees to resolve problems. The impact of the workers' stand was seen the next time the company felt the need to cut wages. They eased the burden this time by reducing rents, and they slashed management wages too. You can bet neither would have happened without the strike. But there was a cost. The company's pledge to not discriminate against the strikers proved as hollow as the famous tourist tree at Stanley Park. There was no return to work for union activists. Strike leader Harold Prichett was among those blacklisted. He never worked another shift at Fraser Mills. With the Depression in full force, Harold Prichett could not find another job for 3 years. He was left to support his wife and 5 sons on relief payments of $47.50 a month. They lived in a shack and raised chickens. That was the toll for fighting back. As tough as it was for Harold Prichett and some of the others at the mill, their experience paled in comparison with the fate of Hans Kiest. He was a recently arrived immigrant from Germany. As a member of the Unemployed Workers Association, he had picketed Fraser Mills in the early days of the strike. Immigration authorities singled him out as a troublemaker and, quote, someone saturated with communistic beliefs, unquote. He was deported back to Nazi Germany. There, he was arrested and thrown into a concentration camp. Hans Kiest died from massive hemorrhaging while he was being tortured. He left behind a wife and child in Vancouver. They were awful times, the 1930s, and some paid a dreadful price. Nevertheless, the Fraser Mills strike is an inspiring example of working class unity in British Columbia. Against all odds, 2 years into the toughest economic meltdown Canada had ever seen, when many unions seemed to lose their way, a diverse group of rank-and-file workers set aside their racial divisions and came together to fight for better wages, better working conditions, and basic respect as human beings. Despite not winning recognition of their union, they succeeded on all other fronts. The secretary of the Lumber Workers Union, M. Palmgren, summed up their achievements in a letter to the Vancouver Sun.
Instead of the Oriental scabbing on the white man, which has always been the bogeyman that the lumber bosses have held over the head of the lumber workers, they have seen Japanese, Chinese, and Hindus stand solid with Frenchmen, Swedes, and practically every nationality under the sun. And the result is that Mackin and the Canadian Western Lumber Company had to come through with a number of the workers' demands. As a postscript, the same could not be said for lumber workers locked out at the nearby Barnett Mill. That long, ugly dispute, filled with violent police incidents, ended when the owners opted to close the mill rather than respond to the strikers' demands. Most of the Barnett workers remained unemployed until the outbreak of World War II. Years later, the city of Burnaby turned the site of the lumber mill into a beautiful recreation area, Barnett Marine Park. In 2018, the BC Labour Heritage Centre installed a plaque at the park commemorating the heroic 1931 struggles of the Lumber Workers Industrial Union. As for the more successful and remarkable strike at Fraser Mills, it should be much better known than it is. I hope we have done it justice. Thanks to Bailey Garden for editing. John Mabbitt provided the voice for Sun columnist Bob Bouchette, while Marc Gamelin was the worker from Quebec. This podcast is produced by the BC Labour Heritage Centre. I'm Rod Mickleborough. We'll see you next time on The Line. Waving high, reinforcements now appearing. Victory is nigh. Hold the fort, for we are coming. Union hearts strong. Side by side, we'll battle onward. Victory will come.
Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2001. That was the day that Thomas Morris Jr. died from breathing in anthrax. A week earlier, he had been exposed to the deadly poison when an envelope containing the powdery substance was opened at the mail distribution center where he worked. Thomas Morris was a member of the American Postal Workers Union. His union brother, Joseph Kersine, died 2 days later. Both men worked at the U.S. Postal Service Brentwood Processing and Distribution Center in Washington, D.C. The poisoned letters were addressed to Senators Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. More postal workers at a distribution center in New Jersey also fell ill from exposure to anthrax poisoned mail. In total, 22 people were sickened by anthrax that fall from letters addressed to politicians and news outlets. In addition to those injured, 5 people died, including a 7-month-old infant who was visiting NBC News in New York City with his mother who worked there. Coming the month after the September 11th attacks, the anthrax poisoning sent another wave of fear of terrorism throughout the United States. The Brentwood Distribution Center was closed down for decontamination until December 2003. When it reopened, the facility was renamed for the 2 fallen postal workers. The next year, Senator Joe Lieberman gave an address to the APWU. He said, quote, "The postal workers who were exposed to anthrax and still got the mail out and kept our system running. They are proud union members. I know I'll never forget that, and America won't forget that. All of you at the APWU deserve our respect and our support." One person suspected of the poisonings committed suicide, and the case was closed. No one was ever convicted of the crimes. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe on your favorite podcast app, and even better, you can like it. Pass it along. You can be part of Labor History Today by reading a labor history item. Just shoot us a note, laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Our music today was Hold the Fort by the Union Boys from their 1944 recording released on Songs for Victory, Music for Political Action. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices, broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to more than 70 labor radio and podcast shows, including Radio Labor, On the Line, Stories of BC Workers, and Labor History in 2, which contributed today's stories. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history. And see you next time.